We're just a few days away from November 6th, of course, the day everything is supposed to be settled nationwide and in North Dakota, and something that a lot of voters in North Dakota may not really have given a lot of attention to right now are the measures that are on the ballot. We've been hearing a lot about the candidates, of course, and a lot of money has been spent to make sure we've heard about the candidates, but the measures have sort of sidled back into the background. So we're going to talk about those today with News Director Dave Thompson, who joins us from our Bismarck studio. Hello, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing, Doug?
Very well, thank you. And Bo Wood, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Dakota, also the Director of the Bureau of Governmental Affairs at UND. So let's jump into this. And first of all, let's start with some of the mechanics behind this. How does an initiated measure get on the ballot?
Well, just in a very brief nutshell, you come up with wording. You have to submit the wording to the Secretary of State, who will look at it. And if the Secretary of State approves the wording, then you can collect the signatures for the initiated measure. Two kinds of initiated measures. One would be an initiated, basically, kind of, just a statute, initiated statute. And that takes about 13,000 signatures. If you want to put a measure in the Constitution, it takes double that amount, about 26,000 signatures.
And I believe that the legislature can initiate measures just as well as individuals can.
Right. And the legislature, if they decide to, and mostly they're constitutional measures, then the legislature doesn't have the signature requirement.
Well, the legislature has a couple of initiated measures on the ballot, and these have been referred to as sort of housekeeping measures. So they are measure one and two. What are those now?
Well, the one, you know, both of them are, in fact, housekeeping sorts of measures. I mean, the first one would remove the authority of the state legislature from the Constitution to levy a poll tax, and it also tidies up some language. To my knowledge, the state of North Dakota has never issued a poll tax, but they have the opportunity, and it's outdated. There's not really anything terribly controversial about this particular measure, at least that I'm aware of.
Well, the federal government spoke out about poll taxes about 50 years ago, didn't it? With the Civil Rights Act.
I believe that's correct.
Yes.
Now, the measure two, this one, it's an oath of office?
That is one of the more interesting stories in North Dakota government. When the Constitution, and the way I understand it, when the Constitution was drafted, there was no requirement for an oath of office for some of the elected officials. Now they want to make that uniform. And it was somebody from Grand Forks who about 3-4 years ago pointed this out to the legislature and said, wait a second, we need this in the Constitution. And the legislature first looked at it saying, nah, I don't think we do, but there was enough hue and cry among some of the legislators that they did put that on the ballot.
Yeah. His name is John Rulsinski?
Yes, John Rulsinski. He's an interesting man. I had a chance to interview him a couple of times.
But he feels very strongly that elected officials should take an oath of office.
Well, not only that, he felt very strongly that North Dakota was not part of the United States of America because we didn't have the oath of office.
Yeah, the U.S. Constitution requires that senators, representatives, state legislatures, and all elective executive and judicial officers take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And so for whatever reason, the North Dakota Constitution only mentions legislative and judicial officers, does not mention the executive branch. And therefore, one thing, though, that I have never known, perhaps you guys know, is whether they do actually take an office. I know it's not in the Constitution, but do they actually take an oath?
Yes, they do.
So we have been fulfilling the requirement, simply not the word.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, that housekeeping is on the ballot. It's measure number two. Measure number one eliminates the poll tax. Measure number two requires the oath of office. Okay. Now, let's get into those that one constitutional amendment, and then we have two statutory initiated measures. The constitutional measure number three of the amendment would block any law which abridges the right of farmers and ranchers. That seems awfully vague.
It does, but it was circulated by the North Dakota Farm Bureau and some of the farm groups, basically. And what they're saying is they don't want outside groups, read between the lines, the EPA or anybody from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to come and put regulations on what they can and cannot do. And that's one of the genesis of it. It's basically saying, you know, let's keep Big Brother, meaning federal government, out of our business.
So this is a bit of a states' rights initiative?
In a way, and it's more of a personal property right initiative.
There are some issues associated with it in that you have some farm groups. The Farmers Union has come out against this.
Right.
And I think part of that is that they're worried that the federal government's not going to stay out, but that the power to regulate those would be taken away from the state and federal law would still preempt this. The biggest weakness in this, though, is simply the vagueness, simply the idea that it's granting in the state constitution, in perpetuity, the right to employ any technology, any farming practice or technology. It doesn't say anything about responsible practices. It doesn't say anything about, you know, how widely used this practice has to be. Presumably, you can imagine a range of practices that would fall under this umbrella that even local residents that live nearby would object to. And, that's setting aside any of the environmental or safety or those sorts of impacts. I mean, it is very broad. And I think a lot of people, those who are opposed to it, fall into that sort of category. It worries them, the broadness of it.
The constitutional language, it's just two sentences, so I'll read it. The right of farmers and ranchers to engage in modern farming and ranching practices shall be forever guaranteed in this state. No law shall be enacted which abridges the right of farmers and ranchers to employ agricultural technology, modern livestock production, and ranching practices. End quote. I don't understand that it's all in the interpretation, isn't it, if you put it in the Constitution?
As a good friend of mine who actually is with the Farm Bureau said, he worries that what they've opened up is a new career for a lot of lawyers.
Yes, okay. Well, let's move on to number four, just to keep them in numerical order. Number four is basically banning smoking. Increasing it to a statewide ban, I guess.
Right, in public places.
Yes.
Now it's municipal, largely in the state. So who's for this? Who's against it?
Basically, health organizations. There are more than 30 organizations that have been listed as supporting this: Tobacco-Free North Dakota, Smoke-Free North Dakota, the American Heart Association, American Lung Association, several hospitals, the hospital associations, the American Medical Association. They're all in favor of this because of the dangers, they say, of secondhand smoke. Who is opposed to it? I'm really not sure, but I did receive a call this week with a Fargo phone number, and the person did one of those pre-recorded things saying, vote against this because it is an abridgment of business rights.
Yeah, there are some interesting dynamics on this one because a lot of the voters who might be in favor of banning smoking already reside in one of the metropolitan areas that have a ban. And so you could argue, if you had, say, a voter that is fairly conservative and protective of individual rights and those sorts of things and really doesn't like a lot of government intrusion, but maybe doesn't like smoking and appreciates the health benefits that come from that, if they're already protected by a municipal ban, you may see them unwilling to extend that to a state ban. At the same time, you've got rural. I think a lot of the doubt or the opposition to this comes from small rural business owners who maybe are the only bar or dining establishment in a town and are worried that that's going to have an impact on their business. And if you go to these little places, there's a lot of smoking that goes on in those. This one, I think, will probably be the closest. If I was to guess, I think this could go either way, simply because they can't count on absolutely the support of people in the big cities that would be in favor of a ban but are already covered by their various municipal bans.
And while we're talking about this, the measure number three was a constitutional amendment. This would be a statutory law. It would change state law. What kind of majority is required for a constitutional amendment or for a statutory initiated measure?
Once it gets on the ballot, it's 50% plus one vote.
So yeah. If you don't vote, that's a no vote, I take it.
No, not really. Because it's 50% of the people who turn out.
It's 50% of the turnout. It's the same as any other election. So right.
But what I'm getting at here is if you go to the booth and you vote for president and Senate and House of Representatives, you say, I don't know anything about these measures. I'm going to vote for those. How does that impact the result?
Not at all.
Okay.
Yeah. It would be the total would be counted for the people that do vote for that measure.
That's right.
And then they divide that.
Okay. So it's just the folks that vote on the measure, not the total vote.
That's correct.
Correct.
Now, have any of North Dakota's political leaders, like the governor, for example, or any of the principal candidates for office right now, spoken up about any of these measures?
I have not seen anything, but that doesn't mean it hasn't happened.
Well, I talked to the governor and on a Hear It Now program a few weeks ago, and I asked him that question just because I was curious. He is yes on number 3. He is yes on number 4. He is no on number 5.
Interesting.
And did he say why?
Number 3, because he believes that farmers should have every right they can to farm and ranch the way they want to. On number 4, he said, I think it's inevitable that the whole society is going away from smoking. Why not be out on the forefront on that one? On measure 5, he does not like the way the measure is written in terms of the animal cruelty thing. We'll get into that, I'm sure, in a few minutes. But he said that he much prefers this compromise that has been worked out among farm groups and some of the veterinary community that would go to the legislature in 2013.
Does North Dakota's appetite for initiated measures – I know lots of states have it, a couple dozen, I think. But does North Dakota's appetite for this – virtually every election we have something on the ballot, this time 5 measures – does that indicate that people aren't working with the legislature or vice versa? How do these happen if you've got a citizen legislature and the legislature doesn't take it up? Is that why the citizens do?
Well, 3 out of these – perhaps. You notice it's worth pointing out that 2 of these are coming from the legislature itself.
Yes, the housekeeping ones, yeah.
Yeah. And so, those are, the legislature is involved. But there are things that are politically divisive. Initiatives tend to be things that a small group of people care disproportionately about. And they find enough people who think and care the way that they do. They believe that there's a greater level of support among the rest of the citizenry than they are able to persuade the legislature of. And so they will go out and collect signatures, and by collecting the signatures, they can demonstrate, in fact, that there's this level of support. And, it's an alternative. It's an alternative to getting it through. Legislatures can tend to be conservative. They tend to oftentimes be risk averse. And so you've got these kind of initiated measures are often a little farther outside the mainstream than regular laws that are passed by legislatures. So,
initiated measure number 5 is that very controversial one about animal cruelty, and we're going to take that one up in just a moment. But first, a break.
It's a night of jazz on Prairie Public. Following the rebroadcast of Hear It Now, we kick it off with Friday Night Swing with Lloyd Anderson. Then at 9 Central, Bob Studebaker hosts as we present both classic jazz from the legends of American music and new jazz from emerging artists. At 11 Central, it's the Jazz Junket with Ryan Switzer, followed at midnight by Jim Wilkie's Jazz After Hours. That's all right here, statewide, on Prairie Public.
That music moves right along. That's Deuce Ambiance from the Gypsy Jazz Classics CD. Deuce Ambiance. Nice rockin' music, sort of, with a guitar and a harmonica. I guess I see the fellow in the photograph. At any rate, I'm Doug Hamilton. This is Hear It Now on Prairie Public, and I'm talking with Bo Wood, the associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UND, and Prairie Public's own news director, Dave Thompson. We're talking about initiated measures on the ballot, November 6th, and One of them has been getting an awful lot of chat. That's measure number 5. Initiated statutory measure number 5 to change state law. It would make it a Class C felony for an individual to maliciously and intentionally harm a living dog, cat, or horse and provide a court with certain sentencing options. What's the problem with that?
Well, go ahead. It sounds
on the surface like, yeah, well, people shouldn't be able to do that.
Well, there are laws. You know, there are laws in place. I believe that most of them are misdemeanors. And so it would mean – one thing here is that it would increase the penalty from misdemeanor to a felony. It also is controversial in that it specifically identifies 3 particular species of animals, and that is a little bit unusual. My understanding is that, in fact, that was an attempt by the supporters of the amendment to not fall victim to the common criticism that their measure was overly broad. And it does have some language in there that includes exemptions for agriculture workers and veterinarians and researchers and hunters.
Mm-hmm.
But – you know, still, I think in the people that I have discussed this with, the conversations that I have had about this particular one, I think one of the main points that people find a little troubling is the sense that, you know, the exclusion or the specific identification of these 3 species of animals, that if, you know, you've got people that are in favor or seem to be either in favor of protecting all animals across the board, or they seem to see no particular reason to protect any of them any more than is currently on the books. And the justification for singling out these 3, it, so far, and what I'm sensing from people is that that's a sticking point for them.
Dave, who's against this?
Who's against it? Our farm groups, who said this is being pushed by a group called the Humane Society of the United States. It was written out of state, they say. And their claim is that this is the camel's nose under the tent, to use that old hackneyed legislative phrase. That once this gets in place, then the Humane Society would have carte blanche to come in and talk about things like slaughtering animals, slaughtering horses, for feed. You know, in certain parts of the country, it is okay to use horse meat, and horse meat is used in some dog food, mm-hmm. and also to get after cattle. You know, what they claim to be is mistreatment of cattle, such as branding. What is interesting, and I wanted to make this point, is that going back to the 2011 legislature, a coalition which included farm groups and prosecutors, veterinarians, had, they thought, was a pretty good agreement to have North Dakota have a felony statute on the books for cruelty to animals. It was introduced in the legislature, and it failed in the legislature because some of the farm groups started backing out. Stockman's Association was one who was raising a lot of concerns about that, and probably it wasn't the best measure in their minds, but what may happen is this measure is going to pass, and they feel they haven't had enough input into it.
And we have this kind of a state's right thing again. We're looking at this outside organization, the Humane Society of the United States. Is that that they're looking at sort of a nanny state from outside the state coming in and telling people how to treat the animals?
In a nutshell, that's what the opponents are claiming.
Yeah, although in every one of these, there's always going to be a local group. There's, you know, in this case, you've got, I believe it's North Dakotans to Stop Animal Cruelty or something that, I mean, there's,
right.
There are always local organizations that are partnering with national level organizations. And so, I mean, you could make the same argument really on any of these, on any initiated measure, that there's, in our current society, there's always a national level organization that's providing support, that's providing language, that's providing legal advice and assistance and things like that. And so, I mean, I think at some point, the whole idea of outsiders coming in and sort of telling us what to do, you know, it has a point of diminishing returns, since virtually every political issue today, it's hard to find anything that is completely local, that has just been, you know, discussed and thought of and organized and structured all by people within a single state.
Well, that also brings up another question, Bo, and I think this is sort of in your area of expertise. Are we really seeing ideological positions being spelled out here? Is this a conservative, liberal type of thing here?
In this particular measure?
Yes. Yeah.
You could say that way. I mean, I think that it's your position on animal cruelty. It's your position on animal rights. And certainly liberals tend to be more willing to support ideas of animal rights, and conservatives seem to see them as less necessary. I don't know how far that stretches in terms of individual rights being granted to animals, but you know, you would imagine that you could find conservatives who are fond of protecting animals. You might also find progressives who think that this is a bit too broad and too unambiguous. I believe that there are some. I had heard that there were some activists that are actually opposed to this measure because they believe that if this measure is passed, it will make it more difficult for them to get a more comprehensive measure passed down the road. So, you know, it's never quite as simple as you think it is.
Mm-hmm. Not by any stretch of the imagination. You are very right.
Given the controversy surrounding two initiated measures that failed due to fraudulent signature gathering, this is that imbroglio that involved some Bison football players, and mm-hmm. They subsequently pled guilty to a misdemeanor regarding the way they were gathering petition signatures for a couple of measures. One would have directed some oil tax revenues to a wildlife projects fund, and the other would have enabled medical marijuana. Can we expect the legislature to take up the issue of how petitions are circulated and signatures gathered?
I'm already hearing some rumbling about that. That maybe not only are lawmakers looking at, you know, clamping down on how petition signatures are gathered and making sure there's enough safeguards in there so things like this don't happen again. I have also heard some legislators start to float the idea that maybe they need to raise the threshold in terms of how many signatures you need to gather before something gets on the ballot. They're just embryonic discussions right now.
They are pretty low. The thresholds are fairly low compared to what they are in other states, particularly for a constitutional amendment.
Are there any limits on measures? I mean, the one I mentioned, the medical marijuana one, that's against federal law. Obviously, other states have gone this route, but there is a controversy and point of tension in those states between themselves and the federal government. Are there any things that you just can't initiate?
That is a good question. I don't know where the outer limits of that are. I mean, I think certainly the trouble with anything is legal. The legal system would be – I think it would be similar to what if a legislature were to pass a law that blatantly was in violation of some aspect of the Constitution or a federal law. On its face, that law would still be valid. It would be valid until someone was impacted by that and then filed a suit, and it made its way through the court system. Depending on the appeals process, could conceivably go all the way to the Supreme Court. But, you know, at some point, a court has to hear that case and rule on it, and they won't take it until someone who has standing, meaning they've been negatively impacted by that law, files suit. So, on the face of it, if a group could persuade enough voters to pass this law, to pass a law that even was contrary to federal law, then it would for a time be legal until it made its way through the court system.
That's Bo Wood, associate professor at the Department of Political Science at UND, and he's joined by Dave Thompson, our news director in Bismarck. We'll have more on the discussion of the measures and the election of 2012 after the news. This is Hear It Now. I'm Doug Hamilton, and welcome to Prairie Public. We're talking about the election of 2012, and there's been an awful lot going on in terms of campaigning, including a decision by a federal judge that may change North Dakota law. Dave, bring us up to date.
The judge has issued an injunction against anybody prosecuting anyone who has yard signs in their yard, or if somebody puts a political spot on the radio or television on election day. Well, North Dakota has a law against it. The federal judge said, no, you cannot enforce that law. That's a lead-in to what a judge may decide about the constitutionality of the law. everybody you talk to who has been involved with it admits that the law is unconstitutional and not likely to survive any kind of court challenge to it. Now, what has happened because of that is that somebody could put a political sign right next to a polling place. That's what they're worried about right now. And the other laws in the other states saying that you can limit where you can electioneer close to a polling place. North Dakota would have no law like that.
Hmm. That would really change the state. I mean, the state is sort of famous for this quiet day.
Yes, and everybody likes it. It's been a tradition for a long time, and it's been in state law for 100 years. But, I mean, there have been efforts in the legislature in the past to overturn it. And as I've mentioned on this program before, one of my favorite quotes was the House Majority Leader who has stood up and said, "We know this is unconstitutional, but we like the law."
Well, I wonder also, we've got – voting has changed in the state.
It has.
You've got all this early voting going on, and it's very substantial now. And, of course, that's happening while all of the advertising and electioneering is going on.
Yeah, the definition of election day is changing.
It is.
And, because of the early voting.
And actually, Bo, you mentioned that this election day may not be the deciding day, at least in one very important race in North Dakota. Expand on that.
Well, we're watching. We're watching the Senate race very carefully. This is probably the closest race we've had, certainly in a long time. And there are some, you know, some national implications. Certainly there's been a flood of outside money coming in to the state, and all of the polls are suggesting that it's going to hinge on who's the most effective at turning out their voters on election day or between now and election day, if you count the early voting. But there are some, you know, there are some questions. Both sides have teams of lawyers that are going to be watching in polling places and are prepared to challenge the outcome, especially if it's within a half a percent. We have to do a recount. And we're, you know, it's the much like our laws associated with campaigning on election day, our laws regarding exactly who can vote and when they can vote and how we determine who is eligible to vote, they are not as maybe robust as they are in some other states. And so you could imagine a scenario if somebody shows up at a polling place and they are unable to demonstrate, to meet the requirements, they can't prove that they've lived here for 30 days or that they're 18 years old or that they're a citizen, then they simply sign an affidavit and then they proceed to vote. And later on, a challenge, one of these two sides could challenge those results and could perhaps lead to action against that individual voter. But to my knowledge, and I confess that there might be a provision that the Secretary of State's office has that I'm just not aware of. They might have a process. But to my knowledge, once that vote is cast, it's not flagged in any way. There's no way to go back and extract that vote from the total. Whereas in other states, someone would cast a provisional ballot that would be kept separate from the regular ballots, and the responsibility is on that person to prove within a period of time, maybe a week, that they in fact were eligible to vote. And once they provided that proof, then that vote is cast and it is tallied. And if they don't provide that, then it's not. It's a provisional ballot.
Now, when I go into the polling place, there are election judges there, and there typically are representatives of the principal parties kind of keeping an eye on voters. Do you anticipate that there might be some actual challenges, particularly these places out west where they've got a lot of new voters?
Well, I do. I think that both parties have a very strong interest in getting as much of that support from these new voters as possible. Certainly, most of those voters are going to have an incentive. They're going to be involved in, you know, the oil extraction industry, and both sides believe that the outcome of this election might have an impact on that industry. So the question is going to be, though, verifying citizenship, verifying intent to be a North Dakota resident. You know, I think it's reasonably it's reasonable to expect that most of these have been in the state for longer than 30 days. The question is, do they intend to become North Dakota residents and renounce their residency in another state, or do they fully intend to go back and maybe either vote in both states or maybe don't vote in the other state this time but really have no intention of becoming North Dakotan? that seems like it certainly sets the stage for potential challenges, no matter which way it tilts. There's so much at stake in a close race like this.
David. And to follow up on that, there are PACs who are actually targeting the oil field workers in Northwest North Dakota, saying, hey, if you vote for X and such, you might lose your job. If you are an oil field worker and you've been in your location for 30 days and you can prove that you've been there, you can vote in our election. So they're already targeting that. And it's going to be interesting, and I think Bo's correct. It's going to be very fascinating to see how intimate, if you want to put it that way, these lawyers from both parties are going to get at these polling places to watch people as they cast their ballots.
Well, you mentioned the importance of the oil industry in the state right now. I mean, it's basically it's just pumping income into the state. So there's an awful lot of, I think, positioning behind candidates or casting of candidates either pro or anti-oil because I think people feel that sentiment in the state, well, all this money is generally good, so let's keep it coming. Kind of thing. But I remembered about a week ago, I got a text, and a number of other people got this same text around the state, and I think some have even complained about it publicly. I'm not complaining, I'm reporting here. The text said, why are top anti-fracking lawyers pouring $2 signs into Heidi Heitkamp's campaign? Call 888 and the rest of the number to find out why. I did not call the number, I simply texted back. I said, why are you texting me? And then I got a call, and it was like an exploratory call, but very quickly the person terminated the call and hung up. And I suspect other people have had this experience, but it does seem to indicate how much interest there is in this election with a certain segment of our economy.
You bet. You know, there are a lot of these kind of techniques are nothing new. They're just new here. You know, I mean, there have been famous allegations as far back, just off the top of my head. I remember the primaries in the South Carolina primary in 2000 when John McCain was, there was a rumor that was started about John McCain that was spread informally. And many people think that that undermined his performance there, gave the election to George Bush. They're just kind of unusual here.
Okay. Yeah, we're now getting into the whole idea of Twitter and social media, Facebook, all these things that are out there. And, you know, as the old saw goes about the internet, well, it must be true it was on the internet. And we know about that.
Okay, garbage in, garbage out. There's another old saw.
Exactly.
Okay. Front page of the Forum on Thursday had a big story. Ad spending in North Dakota draws record tab and Bo Wood is cited in this story. So let's delve into it. First of all, they've got a wonderful graphic of a guest check on the front page of the newspaper. And it says the total for the U.S. Senate advertising expenses over $16 million. Total for the U.S. House, Cramer and Gullison, almost $1 million. The total for the presidential race in North Dakota, $1,264.02. Per eligible voter versus $30 per eligible voter for the Senate candidate. That tells us something.
Well, it tells us that it's not close for the president. You know, it's all about strategic use of resources. And I don't think – I mean, there was a time in the 2008 cycle when the Obama campaign thought that North Dakota might actually be in play. But I think that time has come and gone. And I don't think anybody who was seriously thinking that pouring money into this state would move it in any meaningful way toward a victory for Barack Obama. So, you know, they simply haven't. But the Senate, on the other hand, you know, this is a genuinely competitive race and money will matter. And both sides know that and they have poured it in.
And it's interesting because the Senate is, you know, one vote control right now. It's 51-49. Mm-hmm. And it could go 50-50. And then whoever is elected president and vice president, well, they have the tie-breaking vote in the Senate, which has all sorts of interesting implications, and that's why this one is seen as so competitive because it is razor thin by most polls.
And, of course, we've had Bill Clinton visit the state this week, and he was in Minnesota the next day, which is typically thought of as a pretty safe state for the Democrat candidate, in this case Obama, but apparently that's in play. So there is some strategic investment political operatives in our neck of the woods.
politics is going almost at the speed of light now because people are shifting resources very fast and buying ads very fast and using social media very fast and the internet and their connections with talk radio very fast and talk television. It's all really just going at a breakneck pace.
And sometimes issues actually kind of build on themselves and spread across state lines. And what occurs to me now is that we're right on the border here in Fargo with Minnesota. Minnesota's got two measures on its ballot that are getting an awful lot of attention. One is the voter ID initiative, or excuse me, measure, and the other is the marriage between a man and a woman amendment. And that's getting a lot of talk. A lot of money is getting spent in Minnesota about those issues. And I'm just wondering if they're going to come across the border.
Well, it might be. I mean, certainly everything sort of stabilizes. But, you know, if you look at I don't know, how long has it been since Minnesota passed a statewide smoking ban?
It's been a while, but I'm thinking about these voter ID laws that you're seeing them across the country this year.
Sure. My point is simply that you know, it's, we are comfortable not on the cutting edge. I mean, I don't know how to quite say that in a nice way.
Yes, did it very well. Yes.
So, I mean, many of these ideas, they will make their way to North Dakota, but it will be after we see how they work out in other places first.
Well, I'm still dumbstruck by that amount of money per voter in the state of North Dakota, $32 per voter.
And what's interesting is how much airtime is being consumed by the Senate race, that the other races are getting short shrift because there's no time available. I know if television stations could go to 45 minutes of commercials an hour, nobody would watch, but they'd probably sell out 45 minutes of commercials per hour.
Well, Dave, I happen to know of at least one radio station, and there are probably many more, that's doing 29-minute hours right now.
I don't doubt that. And you remember the old – it used to be 20 minutes an hour or 18 minutes an hour?
Yes.
Back in the day?
That's the standard.
That was the standard, and that was the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters Code. But came Election Day and came Christmas – and people demanded airtime. Well, those things kind of got fudged. Now, in a deregulated environment, if a radio station wanted to put 35 minutes of spots on the air, I think they could do it.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. Most of the time is being taken up by the federal candidates. And so if you're a down race person, say you're running for treasurer or running for auditor, there's not much time available. So you can get what you can get, which is 2 o'clock in the morning during horror theater or something like that. Yes.
Well, you know, I think a lot of that is part of the reason why we haven't seen more activity on these ballot measures. You know, that they simply can't compete with the kind of money and the kind of clout that you're getting in these Senate races. They're being crowded out.
Oh, the other thing that this points to me is the way the campaign nationwide is awash in money. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars being spent on this election cycle. And a lot of the finger pointing is at the Supreme Court for Citizens United. Can we expect any, you know, any rumblings of change, do you think, after this, when people are maybe a little bit tired of it?
Well, there's so much going on in this election cycle. I mean, there are absolutely the issues about spending, and Citizens United is certainly a big deal. But depending on how close the national election turns out to be, depending on whether we see another upside-down election like we did in 2000, if that happens and we don't have the same person win the Electoral College that wins the popular vote, you could see a whole new round of discussion about the continued viability of the Electoral College. I mean, you've got not only there are the small states, you know, the small red states like North Dakota and many of the Midwest and mountain states. In those states, it doesn't feel competitive. A lot of people feel like their vote doesn't count. It's not worth coming out. But now you're getting some of the same sentiment in the big states, in, you know, New York and California and Texas, because they're essentially safe states, although on opposite sides. And at some point, you come to a critical mass where there are enough people that say, I wish my vote counted. Let's do something to change this. And, you know, I don't know if that kind of a discussion was to take place. I could see that taking precedence over, you know, campaign finance reform. I do think that there will be some players that will be pushing to revise this, that will be pointing to the ridiculousness of the amounts. But at the same time, many of these people that are going to be making the laws benefit from the way they're set up now. That makes it really difficult for them to change them. You know, it's an unusual thing for them to vote to restrict campaign financing.
And it's kind of a shame in a way because really people's individual votes can be actually quite critical. I remember it wasn't that long ago that we had that very protracted recount in the Norm Coleman and Al Franken Senate race in Minnesota. And now the possibility perhaps of, you know, we'll have to wait and see after November 6th whether Heidi Heitkamp and Rick Berg will be locked in that kind of a numbers crunch. But Dave, your capacity for political trivia always amazes me. And you mentioned a piece from the past here that really surprised me. And I kind of vaguely remember this when it happened because I was an adult at the time.
That's right. Former Governor Bill Guy, Democrat, challenged longtime Republican Senator Milton Young in 1974. That went to a recount, and I believe the number was 421 votes. When it finally was recounted. And I'll go back even further. 1968 primary. This is terrible. I was just looking this up the other day. In the Republican primary, Bob McCarney defeated Richard Larson by 3 votes.
So everybody get out and vote.
Indeed.
News Director Dave Thompson from our studio in Bismarck and Bo Wood with the Bureau of Governmental Affairs and the Department of Political Science at UND in Grand Forks. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Doug.
And we'll be back with more after this.
After months of heated campaigning and over $1 billion in ads, it all comes down to November 6th, when the voters pick a president and a new Congress. NPR News will be on the air all evening long with the latest results and analysis, plus our reporters out with candidates across the nation. I'm Robert Siegel. Join us for special coverage of Election Night from NPR News.
Coverage begins Tuesday night, beginning at 8 Central Time, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday is movie day at Hear It Now, and Matt Olean, our resident critic, joins us to talk about the movie that has caught his eye this week, and it's Cloud Atlas. You went to see Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, based on a novel and directed by Tom Tykwer and the Wachowski siblings, Andy and Lana, who did The Matrix years ago. This is a mishmash of a lot of different ideas, all kinds of different storylines through all kinds of history. The same actors playing different parts in different times. You have a 19th century slave ship. You have Cambridge 1936 involving a young British composer. San Francisco 1973 involving a journalist played by Halle Berry investigating a nuclear power plant. London 2012 with Jim Broadbent and Tom Hanks and Hugh Grant. You have the future called a Neo-Seoul, that's Seoul, South Korea. Involving some fabricants. They're almost like something out of Blade Runner. You have an even futuristic beyond that with Tom Hanks as a tribesman, joined by Halle Berry. This is called After the Fall. A lot of this stuff I'm sure makes way more sense if you've read the book. The film looks great, Doug. There's some really interesting scenes, but in the end, it's a really loose strand of mishmashed ideas. The stories really don't quite connect. This After the Fall thing is never really explained. It's not a horrible film, but it does not achieve what it wants. It's very pretentious. Lots of ideas going on, and in clocking in at 174 minutes, you know, it's never boring. It's just it does not achieve what it wants to achieve.
Is there a plot? Is there a theme?
The theme is we're all connected through strands of time. By having the actors all play different roles, we're assuming these are previous lives. Mm. And so Tom Hanks' character evolves from an evil ship doctor on a slave ship in 19th century to eventually, you know, turning into a good person in some of the later things. But in the 2012 version – believe it or not, Tom Hanks plays a vicious British gangster who throws a literary critic out a window. Tom Hanks with a vicious British gangster accent is something you need to see to believe. He is woefully miscast in this part. He's also woefully miscast in the ship doctor part. And, you know, Hanks is a 2-time Oscar winner, but he's got a certain persona. And when he's forced to step out of that persona too much, I think they've pressed him too hard. It's almost unintentionally funny. Mm. Some of the roles he plays, Hugh Grant in some absurd makeup in some of his performances is almost comic. And I don't know if the filmmakers intended those to be comic performances or not, but that's kind of how they come off. And so I think that was a mistake too. I think someone younger than Tom Hanks would have been a better choice to play all these parts. Some of the actors fare better. Halle Berry does pretty well with her parts. But the 1973 section kind of becomes sort of a combination of an episode from Streets of San Francisco meets Shaft. Hmm. It's a really weird segment that kind of dissolves into that as well.
How do they get into these segments? Are there titles or do they?
At the beginning they tell you Pacific Islands 1849, Cambridge 1936, okay. And then you're supposed to follow them and they go back and forth. There's really no pattern to the back and forth. You're able to follow it pretty well. But I think the film is overly ambitious and overly pretentious in the end, and it's not making any money at all.
Is the problem with this film that there are too many cooks, too many directors, or do they have their own little piece?
It might be an unfilmable book. That's okay. Possible. I have not read the book. Some scenes are directed by Tom Tykwer, some by Andy and Lana Wachowski. So you have a different visual style going in some of them as well. I don't think that's so much the problem, Doug, as I think the film is too long. It's not really something the audience can latch on to. It's not making a lot of money. Some have wondered if Tom Hanks has maybe passed his day as a major film star who can open a film. Yeah. Larry Crown, big disaster last year for him. Now this film is underperforming at the box office. And you just wonder if Tom is obviously a great star, but he maybe was pressed too hard in this film to play some parts he shouldn't have been playing.
Well, Matt Olien joins us Friday to give his opinion of the film of the week, and this week it's not a high opinion of Cloud Atlas.
No.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 2nd. Within a decade after Dakota Territory was created in 1861, the winds of division were already blowing throughout the prairie. The main population was sequestered in the southeastern part of the territory, and they believed the northern part, mainly centered around the town of Pembina, was of little value and would only delay statehood. In 1871, the Dakota Territorial Legislature, firmly under the control of the southern faction, began submitting a series of petitions to Congress to divide the territory. When the railroad crossed the Red River into Dakota Territory in 1872 and thousands of settlers rushed in for the free land, there began to occur a powerful economic and political shift. And while both the northern and southern economies were booming, they had little connection with each other. Goods and commodities traveled east and west, with traffic going north and south limited to the Missouri River. The southern interests still held much of the power, and in January of 1880, Granville Bennett, the territorial delegate to Congress, introduced the Bennett Bill, requesting statehood for the part of the territory south of the 46th parallel. North of the 46th parallel would become the territory of Pembina. Other bills were introduced, all of which failed for a hearing or for congressional approval, including one that would have admitted the entire state as the state of Dakota. The decisive blow came in 1883 when the northern politicians were able to remove the capital from Yankton to Bismarck. This had been influenced by business interests from St. Paul, who, with their huge investments in land, railroads, and agricultural products, added fuel to the fire in an attempt to cement their control of products flowing to the eastern grain mills and slaughterhouses. The desire for division was so strong that as early as 1882, the Bismarck Tribune was carrying the words Bismarck, North Dakota on its masthead. Division was inevitable, so the only question was when. Dakota Territory leaned heavily Republican, and in the early 1880s, the U.S. Senate was controlled by the Democrats, who were reluctant to add four more Republican senators to their ranks. Near the end of the decade, the political scene changed, and on this date in 1889, at 3:40 in the afternoon, President Benjamin Harrison signed the documents granting admission of the states of North and South Dakota. The documents were covered during the signing and then shuffled to mask which was signed first. Did South Dakota actually become a state before North Dakota, like they had attempted to do for almost 20 years? One will never know. Dakota Datebook is a production of Prairie Public in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, funded by the North Dakota Humanities Council. For more information or to listen anytime, go to prairiepublic.org. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Let's hear it now for Friday, but on Monday, on the eve of the election, we take a break from the serious politics to visit with Rich Rubio. He's the author of The Political Bible of Little-Known Facts in American Politics, a collection of the unusual and often humorous and sometimes bizarre facts and stories about American politicians. So be with us for Hear It Now on Monday, November 5th, and have a great weekend.